Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. We're so sorry about last week. Unfortunately, I had load shedding as we were about to record the AfriCast, so we couldn't be with you last week. But thankfully, there's no load shedding this week, touch wood, and we can bring you the AfriCast. So let's get straight into it. Robin, you've got some news about vaccines that was announced yesterday.
Yeah, so Cyril Ramaphosa had his SONA 2021 State of the Nation address. He obviously touched on a myriad issues around COVID-19 and specifically touched on the rollout of vaccines. People may or may not know that at the beginning of the week, we got some distressing news that the Oxford/AstraZeneca vaccines that had been procured for frontline healthcare workers is proving ineffective against the South African mutation of the coronavirus. As a result, that rollout was suspended, and South Africa had to scramble to find alternatives. So now they've looked towards Johnson & Johnson, as well as Pfizer, and they're also looking at getting vaccines via the WHO moving forward. So next week, or rather, the Johnson & Johnson vaccines, they're going to be single jab as opposed to the two jab that the AstraZeneca one was. Thus far, South Africa has secured 9 million vaccines from Johnson & Johnson. However, they're coming in batches. So the first batch is arriving sometime next week, or at least it's expected to arrive sometime next week. And that'll be 80,000 vaccines. Thereafter, over the next 4 weeks, we should be getting 500,000 vaccines. That's still a little bit less than half of the 1 million that was already secured by AstraZeneca, which also happens to expire at, I think, either at the beginning or end of April. Well,
yeah.
Either way, it expires really soon, so they need to find a way to either use that or sell it to someone else at a cut price, because we're incurring quite a bit of debt trying to secure a vaccine at the moment. So that's kind of where we are at this stage. South Africa also has secured another 12 million via the WHO, and that procurement system, as well as gotten a commitment from Pfizer for 20 million. So that brings us to a nice round total of around 41 million. But again, we have no real details around when the more general public in phase three will be able to start getting vaccinated. So there's still a lot of unanswered questions from SONA 2021.
Yeah, it was a very, here's a lot of statements, not a lot of timelines for things. That's the general mood that I'm getting today. After the SONA last night. I mean, just to divert for a second, did anybody notice that SA Connect was mentioned for the first time in, I think, like 2 years? So if you don't know what SA Connect is, it's government's plan to do broadband rollout throughout the country. It was first announced in 2013, if I recall. The last update, I think, was in 2019 about SA Connect. And we haven't heard much since. Granted, there's the whole wholesale open access network, the spectrum auction that's happening, all that sort of stuff. But I mean, I was just like, I saw SA Connect and I was like, this project is still alive? Whoa.
Yeah, it's almost as if COVID-19 highlighted a digital divide in the country where people aren't getting access to connectivity.
Yeah.
But who knows? Who knows?
And I'm completely missed that part.
Yeah.
Is it still planned to be just broadband? Because, I mean, maybe in 2013 broadband was good, but what about fiber? Does it encompass that?
Broadband encompasses fiber. It's broadband internet.
It's not just copper.
No, it's not just copper.
Okay, cool.
And I think that one of the things with SA Connect, I stand to be corrected, it was quite a long time ago that I read up on this stuff. I think that was their plan was to use fiber infrastructure because copper was beginning to be a bit old in 2013 already. So,
and it keeps getting stolen.
Yeah, and these companies are getting rid of it. These companies, Telkom, is getting rid of their fiber, their copper infrastructure for the most part. So, Hell, I'm just excited to see what's happening with SA Connect now. Like it's been so long since we've heard about that. Anyway, Clinton, you have some news about CD Projekt Red.
Company that goes from worse to worse for these guys. So I won't get into everything going on with the games. I'm just going to talk about the fact that they had a rather large security breach, which resulted in an unknown party running off with almost everything on the CD Projekt servers. Almost everything. The source code for all their games and everything else. So this breach had two factors. The first is that they stole everything. The second is that they encrypted their servers. Now, they left a ransom note with very poorly worded English. And they said, if you pay us, you'll get everything back and we won't sell your stuff. Now, CD Projekt had backup, so the servers being encrypted wasn't an issue. But the fact that their source code got away from them is the big issue. And now, just early this morning or yesterday, depending on your time zone, that source code was apparently sold on the dark web. It was a dark web auction. And now it's out in the wild. Some people don't know where it's going to show up. I've heard some rumors that some people already have it and they're taking it apart. We don't know right now, but it's basically all the modern games that the company has made. The unreleased version of The Witcher 3, the brand new Cyberpunk 2077, the card game Gwent. The complete source code is apparently just out there. And CD Projekt, they had the option to kind of bend to their will and pay the ransom, but they put out a statement, which I wrote about and we'll link to all of this, saying basically we don't negotiate with terrorists, we're not giving you a damn thing. So they've kind of suffered the consequences of that. We don't know what's going to happen with this code. Will people make mods? Will it be sold again? Will it be sold to unscrupulous game developers overseas to make clones? We don't know yet. It's all kind of happening. It's a very fast-moving situation. But yeah, it's not going great for those guys over there. They had a very broken launch of the game Cyberpunk 2077. Was removed from the PlayStation Store. They're being sued by multiple parties, including their own investors. They keep issuing patches, and then they have to release another patch after that to fix problems that the patch introduced. There's a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And also, the latest thing. Yeah?
I was just going to say, whichever board member pushed for the game to be released when it was this broken, I hope that person has been fired.
Well, on the one hand, it's such a complicated situation with a lot of people being driven by money. The investors were pushing to have it released, and then some of the people in management were like, oh, no, the game's fine. We can release it. But we don't know if they were doing that to push it out because they really thought that or because of it. There was pressure from the investors to make money. There was talk of pushing it out for Christmas sales. It's an ongoing situation, both in terms of this hack and as Cyberpunk being so broken. But they are not getting any wins. I can't imagine it's a good time at the offices over there in Poland right now.
So I wonder of the games that you mentioned that were stolen, which is the most important to CDPR? And I have a suspicion that it's probably Gwent, because that game is kind of ongoing and there's microtransactions linked to it with releases to cards and that sort of thing. And I wonder if this is going to force them to have to overhaul their systems for that game. Because, I mean, if your source code's out there just in the ether, I'm sure that's very concerning for both the developer and the shareholders. But yeah, this is not a good situation for CDPR.
And something else is that at the time of the hack, and this is their official position at the time, I was going to say at the time of writing, at the time of speaking, they've said that no user data has been compromised. So for those who don't know, CD Projekt also owns GOG, Good Old Game, Good Old Games, can't speak today. So people worried that if you have an account with them, was your details leaked? Again, their position is none of those details have leaked at all. I'd still recommend that you change your password. And can't remember if GOG has two-factor authentication. I think it does. Do whatever you can because, again, ongoing situation, it might have happened under our noses. Just be really careful as always.
I mean, there's been instances before where a company has said that no user data was compromised, and then a couple of days or weeks later, they issue a statement saying, no, might want to change your password.
just by the by.
We've discovered that there might have been some user data compromise. So like Linson says, maybe just update your passwords and rather be safe than sorry. You don't want to wake up one morning and your GOG account has been hacked. Moving on, I just want to chat very quickly about Salesforce, the enterprise cloud platform. Its president, and I really hate to use this phrase, Chief People Officer, Brent Hyder. Yeah, Chief People Officer. I don't know what that is. HR?
Pretty much. Yeah. It's like being a barman is a what's it?
Mixologist.
Engineers. Yeah, mixologists.
You know, if the profession of being a shepherd was like brought into the tech bro universe, I think that's what you'd be called. Chief People Officer. Shepherd. Anyway,
yeah. So Brent Hyder this week outlined how Salesforce will reopen its offices. So if you don't know, Salesforce is a global company. They have offices all over the world. And obviously with the COVID-19 pandemic continuing to rage on, reopening offices is a concern. But what piqued my interest about the strategy was basically Salesforce is looking at reworking the industrial era, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day from 9 to 5 work. What's the word? Habits? Life.
Work day.
I mean, the work week. So what they are going to be doing is there will be 3 ways for Salesforce employees to work. The first is called Flex, and this is how most employees will work, and it will see them coming into the office 1 to 3 days a week for team collaboration, meetings with clients, and presentations. The next is fully remote, which is very interesting, and that's for employees who aren't near an office or who have roles that don't require being in an office. They can work remotely full-time. And then obviously there will be office-based for employees who prefer being in an office all-time, or even for employees whose job description kind of dictates that they need to be in an office 5 days a week. But what I think is very interesting was the mention, let me actually just read this. In our always-on, always-connected world, it no longer makes sense to expect employees to work an 8-hour shift and do their job successfully. Whether you have a global team to manage across time zones, a project-based role that is busier or slower depending on the season, or simply have to balance personal and professional obligations throughout the day, workers need flexibility to be successful. So I really do want to highlight that project-based role sort of thing, or that way of thinking rather. And what I mean by that is that a lot of jobs these days circle around completing projects. So when you complete the project, you kind of just continue to sit in the office twiddling your thumbs. And I think that this is a very interesting approach to working, is shifting to something that's more project-based. So if there's not a project on the go, you wouldn't come into an office. Now, the problem with this, though, is that at the moment, you're kind of paid for 8 hours a day, or most people are paid for being in an office 8 hours a day and working during those 8 hours. Now, if you shift to something that's more project-based, how does that translate into remuneration? That's not something that Hyder brings up in his post, which leads me to believe that Salesforce, at least, is going to be doing things from you'll get paid the same salary no matter whether you're working at home or in the office full-time. Another important consideration is that by allowing fully remote work, Salesforce says that it gives them the opportunity to shop for talents where they perhaps might not have an office, and be able to tap into those resources in parts of the world where they don't have a presence. And I think that that's pretty key. And when I read this, it actually reminded me of a scene from Silicon Valley where they diversify their developers, and use folks who are working in India and Sweden and a whole bunch of places. And life imitating art, that seems to be what Salesforce is aiming for here. But it's very interesting to see a company as big as this really, really considering how it's going to reopen its offices in the so-called new normal. It's nice to see some companies thinking about this. However, I do stop and wonder how many other companies are going to adopt this sort of thinking or adopt this way of work. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting nonetheless. And for a company as big as Salesforce to consider it, I give them the thumbs up.
Yeah, we've I'll point everyone to other podcasts. We've talked about remote working a lot of times before, and we have kind of a unique position on it because we've been working remote even before the pandemic. And there's lots of pros for workers, there's lots of cons for workers, and the same thing for employers and the overall global economy. When you said they're going to look for talent elsewhere, every time that that fact is brought up, everyone's like, I'm going to lose my job because they're going to outsource me.
Yeah.
That's a legitimate concern.
It is.
That being said, I've spoken to a few accountants and money people in South Africa before, and they said if that's the case, then there'll be a boom in South Africa because of the exchange rate, South Africans work for cheap. Yeah. So it might be bad for people in the US and the UK, but it'll be great for us. So it's such a complex topic.
It really but is.
I think most people would like some opportunity to work from home. Granted, you're not like, I don't know, a Wilder where that's impossible.
I mean, you could.
It sounds like a very like contractor-based system that they want to head towards now, especially when you mentioned that factor about remuneration, Brendan. Yeah. For the contractor, it's simply about hours on a project. It's not necessarily about I've worked 8 to 5.
Well, we'll have – again, I feel like we add a lot of these things to podcast topics. We're like, oh, well, we'll see.
I mean, it is just a matter of these things, you know. I mean, we can't predict whether this will be – and that's the other thing, is whether this model will actually become permanent, because, I mean, there's no saying that this will work. And, I mean, being asked to work from home during a pandemic and opting or electing to work from home are two very different things. Like, not everybody is made for working at home. And also, I think the pandemic has really shown us that it gets really lonely very quickly when you're working from home and not being allowed to socialize and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so, some people just prefer it, even if it means, you know, driving to work, being stuck in traffic. Some people even enjoy driving to work because it's time to, like, mellow out, listen to music or podcast. Some people prefer it. And that's why flexibility is important, because then you can – you know, the workplace can suit the work instead of the other way around.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just draw a face on a volleyball and call it Wilson.
Right, let's get to the meat and potatoes for this week. And this week, we've been reviewing some new kits that was announced late last year and early this year. And I think we're going to start with Robin. What you got for us first up?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I think the beginning of the year is that time when a lot of PROs start pinging us and companies start asking, hey, we've got this new thing that's arrived in the country. Are you interested in reviewing? And we invariably say, yes, please. So our review desk is quite full at the moment, mine especially. I got quite a few things from Samsung. But the first thing I reviewed from them was the Galaxy S21 5G. That's the, I guess, quote-unquote base model. I mean, this is a flagship phone, but it's a base model of a trio of Samsung S21s that they revealed at the beginning of the year. I think, Brendan, you have the S21 Ultra, right?
Yes, I do. And that review will be coming out early next week.
Great stuff. So I think you could probably perhaps chime in here a couple of times and just kind of mention your thoughts as well. But yeah, so I reviewed the S21 5G, and it kind of performed as expected. I think Samsung is in a really great spot at the moment as far as really knocking out great devices. I think back when I first started in this industry, when they had something like the S5, for example, that had like a removable plastic back cover. And I just think about how things have really progressed in that time. And I think Samsung are one of those companies that just make solid phones these days. So as far as the performance aspect goes, everything was really solid all around. What I do want to talk about, though, is some of the more divisive elements. And first and foremost is packaging. We dedicated quite a bit of time to this, I think, in a previous podcast. But Samsung has chosen to not ship the Galaxy S21 series with a charger. And to my surprise, also without some kind of protective back cover. Normally, when you review a phone, or rather when you purchase a phone, you get some kind of generic see-through plastic protective back cover just to kind of see you over or tide you over until you want to buy something perhaps a bit more fancy, a bit more customized. But that wasn't the case here, and it was really odd that there was nothing inside, especially as this phone doesn't come cheap. So the S21, that one retails for you're going to be looking at paying roughly 18,000 Rand. So it doesn't come cheap. And Samsung has taken a lot of care as far as updating the design a little bit. The camera housing is now built into the frame. They've done like a new kind of matte finish on the back cover, which is quite nice. But if I don't have something to protect my 18,000 Rand phone, it does kind of become a bit worrying. And it means that I'll now have to purchase something additional.
So,
and
Robin,
these protective covers don't come cheap either. Yeah, you want to say there, Brennan?
Yeah, so I don't know if you have this problem, but with the Ultra version of this handset, the camera bump is immense. And when the phone vibrates on my desk, I am very concerned that it is getting scratched. Do you have the same concern without the cover?
I wouldn't say the scratch, but it definitely does bulge out.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sit flat against the surface when you're laying it down. It means... Again, if you had a protective cover, it would essentially take care of that issue.
But yeah.
Yeah. So it was really, really odd for Samsung not to include that in the box. And I think you also need to mention we've spoken quite a bit about the chargers. So when I was reviewing this device, I actually used one of Huawei's supercharge plugs.
Yeah.
And it got the job done. But I do worry about the longevity of the battery, especially as this isn't a Samsung or accepted third-party brand that I'm using to charge my phone.
Did it pop up a message when you plugged that charger in that you should use a official Samsung charger or something like that?
It didn't for me. I'm not sure why. Perhaps there isn't a compatibility issue, but these USB standards are so sophisticated now that they will, for example, like you said, pop that up. And if you, for example, ignore it, as a lot of people tend to do, you potentially can void warranties.
Yeah.
So it is something to consider, that you're going to be having to pay probably another 2,000 Rand in order to get a compatible charger, because the one from 2 years ago might not necessarily have the right wattage you need. And you're also going to need a protective cover, because this, like we said, is an expensive piece of kit, and it would behoove you to protect it. That said, I really enjoyed the phone. The UI, Samsung has done a really great job as far as cleaning up things compared to previous generations. That said, Bixby, for some reason, they still want to punch Bixby. I'm not a fan of it at all. Hopefully, they'll wise up to that eventually.
Don't try to make Bixby happen.
it's not going to happen, unfortunately.
No.
But yeah, all around, a great phone. You're paying 18K. It is a lot of money, but you are getting a premium device that performs well. I just wish that now some of the quality of life aspects around after sales was tightened up a bit, because Samsung have kind of missed the mark on that front.
I don't understand it, because I've got a Note 9 and that came with a very cheapo thing. A cover. It must have cost 10 cents to make that cover overseas in China. Why would they not include it? It doesn't. The only reason I can think of is that they must have brokeraged a deal with their like third party accessory makers, and the accessory makers were like, don't include one in the box so we can sell them to people. And Samsung was like, okay.
Or it was just for the environment, brah.
But it's literally 10 cents. Even less than that, probably.
The thing is, if I have to buy one, how does it help the environment anyway? Because the package for this S21 is probably a third less thick than previous generations. So I understand from a packaging perspective, but you can fit a protective cover in here. There's enough space for it.
There's
so
definitely enough space in the box. Yeah. It's
so dumb. It's
so bizarre to me. And I mean, like, other things that I just want to kind of moan a little bit here. or wine rather, all of the paper inside the box really just annoys me. Like, why is that not just a single piece of paper with a QR code on that I can access on the internet? Like, if you care so much about the environment, why do I have 50 booklets in 3 different languages? Come on, Samsung. Like,
because you can't charge people for booklets.
I mean, they're still charging like 18K for the baseline phone. I mean, it's just this whole release of this series of phones boggles my mind. And I'm glad that you had something to say, good to say about your experience with the S21 5G, Robin, because I'm looking at the Ultra and going, who is this phone for? Because just to give you a bit of a preview, the camera is not as great as I feel it should be for this price. The fact that there's no charger means that you are taking 2.5 hours to charge this phone. It's just, there's just so many things that just boggle my mind about the direction Samsung has taken. And I understand you want to be competitive with Apple, but I mean, you're losing the plot. You are trying to emulate Apple to the point where you're just, the phones that you're making don't feel like Samsung phones anymore, at least at the high end.
Hey, speaking of copying Apple, do these things have flipping audio jacks again, or they're still gone?
No, they're still gone.
Oh, my God.
No, they're...
I still can't
plug into a USB Type-C port.
I still can't believe Samsung had the gall to make fun of Apple for not including it, and then the next year they didn't include it.
Yeah.
It rubbed me such a wrong way. They could have just shut up and then removed it, and it would have been less insulting.
Yeah.
But no, they would have been like, hey, guys, we're just like you. We wanted it back. And then they removed it the next year. Yeah. But I don't want to say anything else. Samsung will probably get angry at me. But I wanted to call them back.
Anyway, let me start.
Is the S21 Ultra then kind of shaping up like the S20 Ultra one?
Yes.
Did for you?
Yes.
You had, I guess, similar concerns that it was really expensive, but you weren't really sure who it's for.
I mean, like, one of the things that Samsung really tries to harp on is that this is the ultimate mobile gaming phone. And I will give them that. Every game that I have tested and every benchmark I've run performs better than anything else on the market. Well done. But then you go and look at the mobile gaming space and you're kind of like, okay, this is very lackluster. Am I going to buy a phone just to play games? Probably not. Am I going to spend 28K on a phone just to play games? Probably not. And you kind of start to, when you start scratching at that sticker, and it reveals that there's maybe something that you don't really need here. I maintain that the base model of Samsung phones in the flagship range is the way to go. I think it is the best. And my suspicions were confirmed last year when I reviewed the baseline Note model, and it was a fantastic experience. I loved every minute I had with that phone. And now with the Ultra of the S21, I'm just kind of like, again, who is this phone for? Because if you're a content creator, you're going with Apple. Absolutely, no doubt about it. If you're going with battery life, you're probably going to go with Huawei. If you want a mix of battery life and camera, you're going to go with Huawei. Like, I don't understand who Samsung is marketing this phone at. They used to be like the Note was for business, the S series was for everybody else, and all the lower models were for the middle range. Now I don't know who this phone is for. I'm at a loss.
It's for people who buy the top-end thing just because it's the top-end.
Yeah, and
that is a huge consumer base that, like, we as not those people don't think about. Where they go into a store and they say, what's the most expensive one? Or they don't usually phrase it. Like, what's the best? And then the sales rep will say, this one, because it's the most expensive, and that person will buy it without a second thought. That's who it's for.
Let's stop moaning about Samsung. Clinton, you reviewed a game that wasn't very good, apparently.
Yes, let me moan about a game. So I was pretty excited for this. It's a game called Destruction All-Stars. It's a PlayStation 5 exclusive, which is a whole kettle of fish that we'll get into in a minute. And I was really looking forward to it because it serves an underappreciated genre, which is the vehicle combat genre. Now, when I say that, people say, don't you mean the combat racing genre? Because that's how most people think of it. No, because there's actually no racing in this game. You basically get plopped into an arena and you bash into people, which is fine. And this game, when you play the tutorial, which is about 20 minutes, you have such a good time in that tutorial. It teaches you about all the cool concepts, which I'll get into in a while. And then it lets you go into the main game. And after an hour, you think, oh, that's all the game has. So Destruction All-Stars, like I said, vehicle combat, you crash into people and you get points. That's the main driving force of this game. And yeah, like I said, after a while, you get tired of it. But it tries to do things different by making it seem like an over-the-top sporting event where there's an invisible crowd cheering and everything's televised and everything's bright colors, you know, very American super sport event, superb owl kind of vibe. And the other way it kind of differentiates itself is the fact that there are two basic ways to play. You can jump out of your vehicle at any stage and kind of run around as your characters are called stars. Just think of them as heroes in Overwatch because there is an Overwatch influence here. And you can run around as a little guy or little girl or other. And you can pick up resources to charge up your breaker, which, again, to Overwatch comparison, it's like your ultimate. And then you can also jump into neutral cars, which are splattered around the map. Or after a while, after you've saved enough resources, you can summon your hero vehicle, which has its own ultimate ability. And how this all works is great. The cars feel very, very loosey-goosey, but in that arcade kind of way, which it isn't a problem. Your characters run extremely fast, so it's not always a slog when you jump out of a car. And crashing into things is fun. But the problem is the game didn't develop itself outside of those core concepts. I just want to bring up the thing here. There are, in this launch game, three maps. Three.
What?
You might think, you know, maybe they're really big maps. Maybe they're really detailed. No. There are three maps. They're quite small. They're medium-sized. And the fact is that they didn't do enough to differentiate these maps because you're going, you know, like 200 miles an hour, 320 kilometers. You're going so fast that these maps just blur together. And, you know, some of them have hazards like these big spinning blades which kill you instantly or pits to fall into or what they're called bollards that come out of the ground and you can crash into. But they didn't do enough in the visual department to differentiate these maps. They're just generic kind of neon sports arenas. And three is not enough. And it gets even worse because there's only four game modes. And again, you might think, okay, you know, four game modes, it doesn't sound like a lot, but maybe when you're actually playing, they differentiate. No. The four game modes are all different variants of crashing your cars into other people. There's one where you crash your cars into other people, you get points. That's the whole one. Then there's another one where you crash your cars into people and you get points. But, oh, here comes the differentiator. You only get those points if you bank them in the middle of the map. So what? And then the other two, people might say, my due process here. I can't remember what the other game modes are because they're so similar. I couldn't give a damn. So you have four game modes and three maps. And that's not enough.
No.
So I want to get into the Overwatch comparison here. There are, I'm just trying to go through here, 16. Sorry, I just want to find the exact number. I want to be accurate here. Yeah, there's 16 characters, 16 stars. And again, if you think of it as a hero-based game, which kind of is, 16 might sound like a lot, but so many of them are so boring that you just never want to play as them. It's baffling because the character that you play as in the tutorial, which is probably the highlight of the game, which is the tutorial, which is not a good look, his big ultimate cool ability is that he goes invisible. That's it. It's one of the most boring ultimate abilities I could have thought of. You go invisible. So what? When I was playing online, the character most people seem to be drawn to was called Blue Fang. And if you've played Tekken, he looks exactly like King. You know, the guy
yeah.
The leopard head or whatever it is. And the reason he was chosen the most is that when he's in his hero vehicle, your breaker starts big sores in the front of your car, and then that will be an instant kill if it touches another car. That seemed to be the meta because there's a big focus on multiplayer here. So there's three ways to play this game. There's the arcade, which is just the multiplayer but with bots. So it's nothing. Then there's the multiplayer, which is those three maps and four modes I talked about. And then there's something weird called the challenge series, which is it's so weird. So it's a single player content environment, but but you need to be online to access it. And the reason you need to be online is because to unlock the challenge series, you need to spend real-world money.
Oh, no.
Premium currency, which I'll get to in a minute. And the challenge series, strangely enough, is the best part of the game. Basically, they choose one of the heroes, one of the stars, and you play through a very minimal, quote-unquote, storyline, which is just, oh, one star says, I'm not so good at driving my car. I'm going to drive my car really good for these 7 levels. And then you unlock some cosmetics.
Groundbreaking storytelling there, I have to say.
Yeah, there's no... This is the only part where there's actually, like, some voice acting aside from saying, oh, I hit that car. I'm so good. Oh, my God. Okay, so all of that... it's not rubbish. I don't want to be mean. All of that is so shallow. It feels like there's nothing in this game. And then we get to the way this game is monetized. So months ago, when this was all announced, it was part of some controversy because it was part of those games that Sony was like, we're going to charge $70 for these new games.
Mm.
It's a new generation, $70, you peasants. You'll pay what we tell you to pay. Eventually, that was reversed. And now the game is part of the PlayStation Plus subscription for free. It's not for free because you're paying for the subscription, but it's part of PlayStation Plus until March, so you can play it for a few months before you have to pay for it. And right now, at the time of writing, we don't know what the price will be when it becomes a standalone game. Will it be $60? Will it be $70? Will it be $10, which I think it should be? We don't know right now, but the fact that they wanted to charge $70 for this is so insulting. People back then, when people still thought this was a big AAA experience, they thought that $70 was a stretch. If those same people played the game and still thought it would be $70, there'd be riots in the streets. Now, let's get to the premium currency. It is called Destruction Points. You can buy 500 coins for 89 Rand, 1,000 coins for 179 Rand, and 2,000 coins for 350 Rand. So, those challenge series levels I was talking about, the two that were for sale and I was playing were 200 points and 400 points. So to access either, you would need to spend a minimum of 89 Rand to get 500 destruction points. Mm. And then the skins for these characters, skins are a whole other problem I'll get to. The top of the line skin that is the most expensive is 600 points. So they're very clever here. It's 600 destruction points, but you can't buy 600. Yes. You have to buy 1,000, and then you have 400 left over, which isn't enough for another one of these top-of-the-line skins. And those 600 points aren't enough to buy the skin. You also need 16,500 of the other currency, which you earn by playing the game. And if you're reading this and you're thinking, you know, I play games with loot boxes and everything, that doesn't sound so bad. The skins in this game are so boring. They, you know, again, lots of comparisons to Overwatch because that's a hero shooter. This is a hero car game. They changed how those characters look. They changed their silhouettes. They made them completely different. In Destruction All-Stars, they just changed the colors a bit. I can't tell you how boring those skins are. You know, maybe it's a good thing. Maybe the developers were like, oh, our publisher wants us to put in microtransactions. We'll make the stuff you pay for really boring so people aren't tempted. I'm just shocked by this game. If it was free, it is, again, technically free, part of PlayStation Plus. If this was released as a free game, it would be fine. This feels like a beta for a game that's not coming out for another year. It's so, like, hey, guys, sorry, Brendan, I just want to wind for 2 more minutes. It really feels like they're saying, in another world, hey, guys, this is a beta. We know it's got a very small amount of content, but we're working on the game. Have fun with it now, and we'll have the full game in a year. I can't believe this is a finished first party product from Sony when Sony kind of lives and dies off of their first party content. Sorry, Brendan, I cut you off there.
So something that is very odd to me is, like, okay, cool. They've made a whole game about vehicular combat, but Sony is sitting on a license. I think that they still have the license for Twisted Metal, which is, like, I remember being one of my favorite games growing up, which is a vehicular combat game. And I think it was very popular back in the day. I don't know if there's still a following for that game. I mean, the last one was released in, I think, like 2012, maybe. It's been so long.
Yeah.
But It just strikes me as odd that they would go and create this. Sorry, 2002 was the release of the last one. No, hang on. 2008. Anyway, it astounds me that they would take a risk with this Destruction All-Stars rather than go with something like Twisted Metal. Though I say that, and I also remember that Twisted Metal probably wasn't kid-friendly. I think there was like an 18 age restriction on it because there was language and violence and nuclear weapons and all that sort of stuff. I'm hearing what you're saying and I'm just like, why didn't they just get some developers in to remake Twisted Metal or like do a like Twisted Metal remastered? I mean, the game was released in 1995. I'm sure somebody could do something with it.
Yeah, everything about this game is perplexing. All the decisions behind it are very strange. And again, it had a cool concept. And the driving and the running around, the like core idea is pretty good. And then everything around it is just baffling and makes no sense and is very anti-consumer. It's very weird. If you were looking at this thinking, I've got to buy a PlayStation 5 for it, please don't. I'm flipping out. This is such a nothing game that we're going to forget about it in 2 months when it leaves PlayStation Plus. Yeah, so I have my full review. Everything that I've talked about here, I've gone into greater detail there, so there's more whinging. Robin, do you want to mention anything about this before we move on? Because there's so little in this game, I don't think we should dedicate much more time to it.
Yeah, I think probably the less said, the better.
Yeah,
bring back Twisted Metal, Sony.
Yeah,
Twisted Metal remake.
Real wasted opportunity, full of absolutely bonkers business decisions. If you have a PlayStation 5 and PS Plus for other reasons,
the five of you really, that do.
Yeah, it's really one of those games which you can download, play, and then delete in a single afternoon, and you'll never think about it again in your life. Do that. Otherwise, don't worry about it.
Right, let's get on to something happier, although that's kind of just about the opinion. Robin, reviewed the Little Nightmares sequel.
Yeah, that's right. I think I wouldn't say the game made me happy, but it was definitely a happier review experience than what Clinton had. Yeah, so like you said, Little Nightmares 2, it was released earlier this week on all platforms. And we got to review it on the PlayStation 4. So I just need to kind of say from the outset that I'm not really a big survival horror fan. Stuff like Evil Within or Resident Evil, those kind of games aren't really up my alley. But I really, really was interested in playing Little Nightmares 2 purely for the fact that I found the art style really intriguing and the fact that it was more of a platformer in the way that it tried to handle the survival horror aspects. Than just try to escape or shoot your way out that the other kind of gory, more jump scary survival horrors try to do. So I really enjoyed this one. Like you said, it's a sequel to a 2017 original title that I think garnered quite a bit of interest because a lot of people were playing it on video platforms, so YouTube and stuff like that. But for this new game, the developers, and I apologize if I'm butchering the name here, Tarsia Studios, they've changed up the formula slightly. So instead of playing as Six, who is a young girl in a yellow raincoat, a very, iconic look, especially if you're a Coraline fan. So instead of playing as Six now, you're playing as a character called Mono, who's a young boy, and he wears a box, cardboard box for a head for some reason. The developers kind of added this ability to earn different masks in-game. If you want to get into that, I didn't really focus on that. I was more interested in the way that the game was kind of put together. Can I just
ask, why did they name their character Mono?
That I don't know.
Okay. Just a weird choice because it's... if you don't know, it's also colloquially known as the kissing disease. It's not a very it just boggles the mind. Carry on, sorry.
Yeah, so sorry, you just took me down a tangent. you do interact with Six in the opening prologue of the game, you actually save her from a house where there's a masked hunter who also does a bit of intense taxidermy. And you kind of have to try and escape from this house, and you eventually get onto a... You float on a wooden door towards the city, which is perhaps equally, if not more, terrifying than the woods and the house you had just escaped from. Yeah. So your role in the game now is not as Six, where you played as a very fragile, vulnerable character trying to escape. You're now taking on the role of Mono, who is, I guess, a bit more driven in the way that he goes about things. And I did find it interesting that they changed up the motivations of the protagonist. Mm. I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing, because, again, you fall into the traps of damsel in distress kind of gameplay. Mm. I don't think that's really necessary for this game. I think it stands, well, rather the previous game stood up on its own account. It didn't necessarily need those kind of elements to it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, I guess, a bit more subjective. Some people might not necessarily feel that way. Perhaps I'm overanalyzing it. But as far as the way it's presented, it's eerily, terrifyingly magnificent. Like I said, I really enjoyed the art style. It reminds me a bit of some of the horror tales that Roald Dahl used to do. And if you see some of those illustrations, stuff like witches, for example, that's kind of how the enemies, most of whom are adults in this game, are designed as. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Another great thing that Tarsier does in this game is use sound to great effect. For example, if you're walking in a wooded area and there are steel traps on the ground that are unseen, you start to hear almost like metal on metal just in the faint distance. So you know that there's something that you need to be aware of that might happen, and you have to be a bit more cautious. Also, if, for example, are in houses and stuff like that, all of a sudden all the ambient sounds are amplified, and every movement you make also gets amplified. So you have to be very careful in terms of how you move around in an environment, not knocking anything over, because if you do, you might trigger enemies coming to kill you, essentially. Also, a bit like Cyberpunk, the soundtrack is used when you're in enemy fighting situations where you're trying to essentially elude the enemy. The music is amped up again there. So I really enjoyed the way that they use music as a way to pace the gameplay. I really enjoyed that aspect. But for as much as I really enjoyed The Nightmares 2, there are a few hiccups, and those mainly fall on the mechanics of the game. I guess as a general rule for the game, you move around relatively slowly. Your character isn't quick or agile or anything like that, and that's purposely done. But you are able to run, for example, if you need to flee an enemy, or if there's an object coming towards you, you need to try and escape it or get out of its way, you are able to run. But it's done in such a way that you still move in a very languid fashion. And a lot of the time, I just find myself being killed fairly innocuously, despite me spamming the run button. Nothing was really happening. I also found that climbing up objects proved a little bit difficult. It didn't necessarily respond as quickly as I needed it to. There are, I guess, mechanical issues with the game that, with a bit more, I guess, spit and polish, it could have been tightened up a bit more. But these aren't necessarily elements that are going to stop you from enjoying the game. I think it's all, like I said, stands up on its own, just from a storytelling, design, art style, and I guess sound mixing or sound design perspective. So, like I said, it's not one of those survival horrors that is terrifying in a gory way or tries to use jump scares too much.
Yeah.
It's more about what lurks in the shadows, what you're not necessarily seeing in frame as you're scrolling, moving from one side of the screen to the other with your character, Mono and Six. So really enjoy the game. I also like the fact that it's not expensive. I think in this age of next-gen consoles, you're always expecting to pay $1,000 plus for a game. And this one only retails for 540 Rand, which is still a lot of money for a lot of people. Mm. But you're not paying double that, which is normally what you're paying for a new game these days.
Sorry that you guys are hearing my typing. I just want to see. Maybe, it is available on PC. It's probably cheap on Steam. Let me just check. So it's $29.99. On Steam, it's still pretty expensive, 429 Rand. And there's actually a demo. I didn't know that. Yeah, so you can, you know, aside from what everything Robin has mentioned, you can go play the demo. You can decide for yourself. And, sorry, I don't want to take over the conversation here. I just want to see how much is Little Nightmares 1, because you might as well. Little Nightmares 1.
If you haven't played that one, you should definitely, just for me, check it out.
Yeah, it's 8.0. Okay, so it's on sale. It's usually 400 Rand, which is it's actually more than I remember. Until 15 February, which is Monday, it's 79 Rand 80 cents, which is really good value. Robin, again, I don't want to take over the conversation here. I just want to ask you something. It is called Little Nightmares for a reason. Your characters are very small. do they bring that kind of weird scale stuff to the new game as well?
Yeah, so I think you're playing as both your characters are 9 years old, but it is very much like, I guess the scale would be 4:1.
Oh, wow.
So everything around you is far larger. So Mono, for example, he tries to, when he's saving a 6 in the opening prologue, he finds an axe and tries to wield it, but he can't actually lift it up. It drags on the floor, making a hell of a lot of noise. And when he tries to swing it, sometimes it does work, sometimes it doesn't work. So yeah, I think that they have really played to that aspect of the game. Also, your size does help you because you have to get into nooks and crannies that the fiendish adults aren't able to. So yeah, that is a key element to the gameplay.
So I have a very important question. Is it scary?
It's scary in, I guess, a different way. Again, I'm not a fan of jump scare games, and perhaps I've been desensitized from 90s television.
Yeah.
But I guess it's more the anxiety. I would say actually the first game, Little Nightmares, where you're playing a 6, is far more scary moments, purely for the fact that the character itself is not as quote unquote strong as Manu is. So yeah, again, there's a subtlety to it. It's not out and out scary. It's more, it'll make you feel really anxious about things, which I don't necessarily think is everyone's cup of tea given the past year we've had.
Yeah,
but yeah, a very good game nonetheless.
So I have another question, sorry, breaking in here. I want to ask you, there's a very famous scene in the first game. Some people call it the table scene, the meat eating scene, whatever you want to call it. I won't tell what happens in that scene, but many people say it's the worst / best part. Is there a kind of standout scene in the second game that people are going to be talking about without spoiling anything?
Yeah, there are a couple scenes when, so I guess, yeah, this is common knowledge if you go to the game's website. You're trying to help Six invade the clutches of this, essentially this ominous-looking tower in the middle of the city that emits light. And you're kind of working your way from one part of the city to the other, trying to escape it. And there are a couple scenes in a school that are very interesting. And if people play it, they'll definitely be talking about it.
Okay. I'm very intrigued. Like, so at the moment, I'm trying to battle my way through the medium from Blooper Team. And I say battle because, number one, the game is very difficult. Number two, the game is very, very scary. And I've had to just Alt F4 more than once. The problem with that is that the horror takes over from the gameplay and takes away from the story. I still have a ways to go to finish it, but that's one of the issues that I have with horror games, is that sometimes if you go too far, the horror overtakes the gameplay. Like, I remember this very clearly playing The Blair Witch, which was also by Blooper Team. And that game, as great and as intrigued as I was by the story, eventually I was just too terrified to continue playing the game. I know that seems really silly because, I mean, it's just the game, Brendan, but the psychological aspects of these survival horror games, I think they're really trying to hammer that home. And that's why I asked if this game is scary, because like I enjoy horror, I really do, but I don't want to not be able to sleep that night. And I feel like this is a nice balance of like horror with some really interesting gameplay, and marrying the two in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, if I had to, I guess, equate horror games to horror movies.
Yeah.
This game feels a lot like Hereditary.
Okay.
It's a lot about what's happening in the background. You don't necessarily see it. It's not on full display. Like a normal horror would be.
Okay. I actually prefer that, because that's more like suspenseful and there's an air of mystery to it. And that works in a game, because you're constantly wanting to find out what's happening next. I like that. So I'm actually really curious about this game, and I think I might actually play both of them, because I haven't played the first one.
The first one is definitely good. Second is highly recommended.
Awesome. Great. And I think that's going to wrap it up from us for this week. We'll have links to all the stories and reviews we've covered in this podcast below, or above rather, where you're listening to this from. And you can just read the stuff in full. But from myself, Brendan Lott, cheerio from Klitsimatos.
Bye, everybody.
And from Robin Lee Chetty.
Take care, everyone.
We'll see you next week. Cheerio.
Bye.
The number you have dialed is not in service at this time.